Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, March 1st, 2012. And this week, I'm going to be talking about, I actually alluded to this topic last week, and I thought it would be a good idea to go into this, one of the standard science papers that claims that there are millions of nomad or billions of nomad planets swarming through the solar system, and that these bring life to the Earth or to the other planets. It's a topic that's really very ridiculous, mainly because it just takes one step further. It offsets the issue of where life came from. Actually, it complicates it tremendously, because if you are told by these people, by these scientists, so-called respectable scientists, that life formed somewhere out there and it jumped onto these nomad planets, and then that they somehow collide with something and that sprays life all over and then finally lands on a planet like Earth. The story is so far-fetched and so remote that it begs, it's not even borderline ridiculous. It's out on the far side, other side of the universe ridiculous. But this is being touted as the new wave of discovery and knowledge in standard science. So the reason it's important to touch on this, I can talk about what's being fed to the public out there, the garbage fairy tale science, but I can also talk about what's really going on out there. The last 2 weeks, I talked about the Planet X in other solar systems, Planet X's in general, and the need for these to generate life. And so I thought it was humorous that the morning before my last show, NASA comes out with this big, broad announcement stating that life generates, they don't even say where it generates, but they say that the bacteria jumps on these planets that are wandering through the galactic space, not associated with any stellar system or planetary system, just wandering out there, and then that these collide with something, and that blows pieces of this all over the universe. Those little pieces somehow land on a planet and begin life. The remoteness of this as being somehow a mechanism that works to spawn life on planets. And then let's go back a couple of weeks where I talked about an announcement where the Standard Science came out and said, we are probably the first intelligent life in the universe, or we have we're on the cutting edge. We're probably one of the first intelligent species in the universe. Where do these people get this? Where on earth do they get this? But it's just like I say, so remote that it begs some commentary. At any rate, that'll be the main science topic. But the other thing I wanted to talk about, this is a listener topic that they brought up. I've talked about this many times before, and here's the situation. There's a lot of talk about the Mayan calendar, and it's a complex topic, so I'm actually going to talk about that first. The Mayan calendar, where did it come from? And once again, my 2-CD set that talks about the ancient Mayans and the modern Mayans, just two of the topics in 18 hours of lectures on the 2-CD set. The ancient Mayans were, let's go back, they are called the Olmecs. And this is kind of a broad term. Not much is known about the people from that era. Probably about 1500 BC to 4000 BC. In Mesoamerica, in Mesoamerica, there are gigantic round rocks, and they're carved in the face with the face of a figure, kind of like a Polynesian type of face. And they're just sitting out in the middle of the jungle, in the middle of nowhere, and no source for these rocks. It's very strange. But that's the only remnant we have from the Olmecs. Certainly a technology that would require the ability to work with stone to move these massive stone pieces and place them. But they're just, many of them are sprinkled around out in the jungles of southern Mexico and Central America. So those were what we call the ancient Mayas, but there has to be a lot more. They are the ones that invented the calendar, the Mayan calendar, and at the time when they invented it, it had 360 days. The Aztec calendar, which is a modern adaptation of that. By the way, when you look up Mayan calendar, in all of the so-called wonderful self-appointed experts out there that talk about the Mayan calendar, what they are showing you is the Aztec calendar, the sun calendar. And it really is not the Mayan calendar at all. The Mayan calendar, the Aztec calendar, is an adaption of the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar, the true Mayan calendar, of which they actually had many. They had ceremonial calendars, they had ritual calendars, they had business and economic calendars, they had calendars to plant and harvest by. They had many different calendars, but the main calendar, the one that is kind of referred to when they talk about 2012 and December 21st, that calendar is from the Mayans, actually the modern Mayans, of about 1300 AD, which is very clearly a carryover from the ancient Mayans. It has 360 days in its calendar. This is what Velikovsky was talking about, and by the way, from all of the hullabaloo and all of the name-calling about Velikovsky, because he talked about astronomical events and Venus becoming a planet, things that standard science cannot understand, doesn't want to understand, and denies. Yet they'll talk about rogue planets wandering through intergalactic space, colliding with other rogue planets, which is about as improbable as can be. But they won't allow the fact that something could come into the solar system, be captured, and then work its way in and become a planet. But the standard science is just in a rut, let's put it that way. And it's a rut that's very important to the people in power of the world. I talk about this a lot in my radio shows, but let's go back to the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar has 360 days. That is associated with the cycles of Venus. It's a very strange combination. And so what the modern calendar people do is they add 5 days to make 365 days that we have now, and even that fails because the 365 days, there's a quarter day in there, and so every 4 days we have a leap year, adding 1 day to February, which we are coming up to here. Which we had yesterday, the 29th of February, 2012, is a leap year. So at any rate, the point is that the calendars don't really add up, and the Mayan calendar has 360 days. So if you go back in history to around 1300 AD, before the Spanish ever showed up in the New World, and then start counting and try and associate that with our current calendar, which you really can't do, but if you tried to do that, you would end up at the end of that calendar cycle a long, long, long time ago. Not by magically adding 5 1/4 days to the calendar. You see, it doesn't add up. And I've talked about this on my show previously. This past week, a listener wrote in and asked me to talk about this. So I thought, yeah, it'd be a great topic to clarify since we're in 2012. It's something that I have to repeat. Now, why were the Mayans so preoccupied with Venus? Well, let's go to Zimbabwe, which really isn't called Zimbabwe anymore. But probably about a decade ago, there was a rock circle discovered in Zimbabwe. And they discovered that it was tracking the planet Venus. What was very interesting about this tracking calendar was that it was in the form of a circle. And the point is that Venus was on a very different track, a very different orbit when that calendar was made. Because right now the planets move around, including Venus, moves around the Sun. So if you look at the Sun and you look at the relative position of Venus, it simply moves back and forth near the Sun. It's the morning star for a while, then it's the evening star, and in its orbit around the Sun, which is inside the Earth's orbit, it simply moves back and forth around the Sun. And so there's no need to have a full circle calendar for searching or taking tracking the planet Venus. So clearly that calendar has to be very old, and that was keeping track of Venus back in the old days. That was when Venus was a comet. That's when Venus had an erratic orbit. The Velikovsky talks about the Mayan tablets, the clay tablets that give the positions of the planet Venus historically. The ancient Mayans give it many different positions that don't add up with modern astronomical positioning of the planet Venus. So the point is that Venus's orbit had changed. It's apparent that Mars's the orbit of Mars, the planet Mars, has changed. Mars was said to have a blue appearance, just like Earth would have a blue appearance. It was a water planet. I talk many times about, I think it was last week I mentioned that NASA says, one of their recent announcements, 600 million years ago, they say Mars had water for a brief period, 5,000 years, I'm sorry, and then that was it. Where did the water come from? How did it magically leave Mars? With all of the erosion that we see today, it had to be a vast amount of water, but it magically left Mars. They don't say how it got there or how it left or how it managed to cause erosion that's still visible today, allegedly 600 million years later, with all of the dust storm and activity going on the planet Mars. So, once again, standard science. Something in one of my notes here, it says to talk about peer review. If you look at my homepage, the jmccsci.com homepage, if you scroll down, you'll see something called a peer review. It's a subpage, a critique of peer review. And I start out, it reads backwards. In other words, the very first thing you read, the bullet item or the first dated item, is the most recent. And I haven't updated it for a long time, because I pretty much said everything I wanted to say. But if you go back down to the bottom of that subpage and you start out, I say that peer review is kind of an old man on a highway that drives slow in the left lane on a busy, crowded freeway. He never has a problem with traffic. All the traffic in front of him is he doesn't have anybody in front of him. He's got a nice, big, open lane. And so he can't really understand why all those people are behind him honking and trying to get around him. And that's the case with peer review. It's a double-edged sword. Peer review is a good thing. It's meant to be a good thing. but it's being abused by the monopoly groups in science today. There's an effort right now to have free publication of science on the internet. Well, in a sense, you already have that. Anybody that wants to can get on the internet, have a web page, and say whatever they want. And so, like, when I started my web page, it was really the first one that even touched on this topic. And all of a sudden, bing, 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 here and there, the copycat wannabes started popping out of the woodwork. People with no degrees, people with no background, people that have never done anything in their lives except sit in grandma's basement, all of a sudden became experts on all kinds of topics regarding comets, and everybody was an expert. And then NASA had to respond, so they came up with their laundry list of, I call them Trekkies. But at any rate, the point is that the issue with a lot of these topics I had been talking about back into the 1970s, and I have a paper trail. That's something I have that other people do not have. If you look at my books and you look in the appendices, a lot of those a lot of that paper trail is there. That's something that other people don't have. It's easy to claim, I've been researching this for 30 years. Yeah, in grandma's basement. But the other flip side, as I said, is standard science. Okay, so back to the Mayan calendar. If you look at what is really the Aztec calendar, the Aztec calendar is a series of wheels, and the wheels rotate one notch at a time. So let's imagine wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels, and each wheel has a series of spokes on it, so to speak. So you take the innermost wheel and you start turning it. Click, 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 click. When it gets around once, a complete path around the circle, click, the next outer circle clicks one time. And then you click, 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 all the way around again. And then the outer circle clicks one more time. So the next outer circle has clicked two times, two clicks. And then there are different number of stations on each expanded circle. And so what it is, it's just a counting device. Nothing more, nothing less. It's click, 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 click. And then when the next outer circle gets completely all the way around, then it causes the next circle to click once. And so you see how this goes. And so it's a counting system. That's all calendars are. They're just a series of counting circles. Okay, well, at any rate, that's what the Mayan calendar is, but it adds up to 360 days. So it's very easy for anybody with just that basic piece of information. It's very easy to determine that the Mayan calendar really does not associate with the Gregorian calendar that we use today. The type of calendar that is used to count today, or the celestial calendar, astronomical calendars that are used in science, they don't match. There's really no way to match this up. And the Aztec calendar has the other future adaption that was not really present in the original Mayan calendars. The Aztecs concentrate on the sun and the moon. If you go to the main Aztec centers with the pyramids, you find the pyramid of the sun, the pyramid of the moon. You don't find those if you go back to the Mayan sites in southern Mexico or Guatemala. You don't find really much at all dedicated to the sun or the moon. And there's a real misconception. Let's go to a place called Chichen Itza. You can look that up on the internet. Hopefully many of you have been there. It's a tourist site. Beautiful architecture on the pyramids. And what a lot of people don't understand is the pyramids are not aligned north, south, east, and west. They're about 13 degrees off. And it must be probably a good 10 years ago I did quite a bit of surveying around that part of Mexico with surveying equipment, and I went to Uxmal and the other Mayan cities, and what I discovered is that the grids that the cities are laid out on don't match. They're off. If you go from one city to the next, they're off a little bit from one to the next. And so what happens if you take the grid lines from true north and take the offset of the actual grid lines that the cities are built on in the main pyramids and religious structures, you find as you run those north, they cross in a place in northern north of the state of Michigan in Canada. In other words, the old North Pole that they faced was in the in Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that the Mayan cities are built on a gridwork that does not face our current northeast, south, and west. Yet, modern archaeologists ignore that. There's a ceremony that takes place, I believe it's on March 21st, every year at Chichen Itza, at the pyramid there. And it's dedicated to Quetzalcoatl, who represents Venus. Yet the modern archaeologists say, oh, well, this is related to the solstice. And so why would you build a pyramid 13 degrees off east and west, north and south, the current readings, dedicated to the current solstice, the way we have it today? And then what happens as the sun rises, or as the sun sets, the steps coming down, I believe, the north side of the pyramid, create a shadow in the big snake-like structures that are built into the steps. And what you see is kind of the steps moving as if the snake were moving. And people go, ooh, goodness, that's the Mayans were talking about the solstice. Well, no. If you are going to build a pyramid dedicated to the primary directions northeast, south, and west, you would build it northeast, south, and west. And if that were the case, when you went over to Uxmal or one of the other Mayan installations, you would also build that on the same gridwork. But they're all slightly juxtapositioned. And so what it's really telling you is that the Mayan cities, the modern Mayan cities, are built on the old gridworks. It's like, let's take New York City just as an example, or some other city. Most cities are laid out north, south, east, and west, and the streets are laid out that way. So if you say you had a major disaster and the earth shifted, the poles, the celestial poles, the rotational poles of the earth shifted, and let's say about 30 degrees, okay, then the next population comes along to rebuild the city, unknowingly, unwittingly, building the city on the old gridwork, on the old lines that were set up on the old city, not really understanding that the Earth's poles had shifted. Okay, what does that mean? That means that the Mayans rebuilt their cities on the old gridwork. Okay, so you have modern cities that don't point towards the prime meridians, but modern archaeologists are not permitted to talk about that because astronomy, the leading science, they always get a kick out of astronomers. They say they're the closest to God, which would imply they're the closest to the truth, but nothing could be farther from the truth. The point is that modern astronomy denies all of the disasters that happened in Earth's history, making claim that none of these major disasters happened. They talk about asteroids colliding into Earth, but I've talked about this on my show, that asteroid collisions and their effects have been vastly overstated, vastly overestimated. And really, the energy is absorbed locally. So, at any rate, the thing I'm pointing at here is when the big comets come through the solar system, the Planet X comets. Let's talk about Planet X. Let's talk about Comet X. Maybe that's a better term. Because Planet X implies a big round object, some kind of like a Jupiter-looking thing that comes floating through space, and that's what you're supposed to see. That's one of the biggest misinformation pieces out there, as I've said this before, that the two biggest misinformation pieces out there is, number one, that there's just one Planet X. And since it didn't come and people predicted it, then there's none, so don't believe in it. It's foolishness. Okay, that's the first misinformation hurdle that you have to get over. The second misinformation hurdle is that it looks like a planet. This big and round and orange and looks like a brown dwarf or something. No. It's going to look like a big, raging, ridiculously raging comet. So at any rate, okay, so anyway, that's a bit of a review of the Mayan calendar. It does not, I repeat, it does not predict the end of the world on December 21st, 2012. Never did, never will. It predicts the end of a cycle, and those, it's just like any clock. Let's talk about the Y2K. Remember the Y2K, all the computers were going to crash, it was going to cause the world to end, all of these things, and nothing ever happened. I went on the radio in my program before Y2K and told people, I said, nothing's going to happen. Look at a computer register. A register in a computer is like a memory, and it has certain, it's a binary system, so it has zeros and ones, and it has a certain dimension. It has a certain amount of space in it. And so you have all kinds of clocks and timers going on in computers. They're basically little clocks. They're little binary digital clocks that go click, 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 billions of times per second. And so they clock up, and then they recycle. And so what do? They're constantly running up to their highest bit setting of all ones, and then what the next cycle is, all zeros again. Computers do this all the time. So there's no magical thing that's going to cause all the computers in the world. There was like some glitches with Windows and things like that, but you know, this was a very minor issue, because the typical mainframe computers, the typical, what they called at the time, legacy computers, the big IBM and the other Honeywell or other types of major computers that were installed in industry bases at the time, did not have a problem, never would have a problem. So it was a constructed thing, obviously forced by government controlled misinformation, and the people repeated it. Everybody was like, Y2K, the world's going to end. And I happened to be associated with companies that had major preparations going on for Y2K, and all the managers were running around and looking important, having meetings, and nothing happened. Nothing ever would have happened. So at any rate, the point is that talking about preparation, I want to kind of take a right turn here and talk about leading up to preparation. Preparation first is being happy, being satisfied. There are many people out there that don't know how to be happy with a little bit. They don't know how to be happy with what they have. They always have to be pursuing more, and they don't even have the next thing they're getting, and then they want two other things. Those people are very unstable, unhappy people. And if you happen to have the misfortune of being associated with someone like that, it's a very difficult thing to deal with. A lot of times these people are impulsive. And so how do you control an impulsive people? How do you deal with an impulsive person? It's very difficult. It's very, very difficult. So the first thing, you have to be relaxed. You have to be satisfied with what you have. And a lot of these people are what you call caretakers, people who they're trying to run everybody else's lives. And as a result, who flocks around them? The people that don't have any decision-making ability, people that don't want to take care of themselves. And so those people just kind of float. And a lot of times the caretakers are associated with other people, and they tend to drag all these people along with them. What does this have to do with preparation? If you ever become involved in an emergency situation, all of these people will not know how to relax, calmly address the future, calmly address the issues at hand, and let's put it this way, just take care of business. Just take care of business and be happy at the same time. Because a lot of times things are just out of our control. I should say that the world has to get control back from, like, the bankers. It has to get control back from the governments that are controlled by the bankers and all of the bizarre things, the psycho-bizarre fascist things that are going on in the world today. Let me just take an example. All of the issues that have been going on in the Middle East for the past, it's not just the issue with Iran now. That's just the current one. This stuff is going on all the time, and it has been for the past 30 years, 50 years, more, 100 years. But the common person really does not have a lot of control over this. This is handled by people that you don't see. You don't see their names. They're invisible. But I will say this, that over the level of control of all of these governments, the ones that are opposed to each other and having, the verbal face-off, so to speak, I see the world is being controlled by a very few people at the very top and their families. And they're in all countries, and they're all related. And with stress, with upheaval, with political upheaval, they can maintain power. And it's a formula that's tried and true and very old. And you can, just like in the United States, you can come along and start a war every 10 years, sometimes with the same country. We attacked Iraq twice for worthless, no good reasons, and within a 10-year period, the two presidents were father and son, and looks like the next son will be possibly be a president, either if not this term, coming up at the next one. It's just the world political situation is so absurd. But the point is that the average person on the street is just unable to control or unable to make any effect on this, because basically the monopoly game of the world has been won. The chips are all in, and you've lost, and a very few people have won. Okay, I'm going to switch gears now and go into the main science topic. And this is very complicated. That's why many times I'll pick a topic like this and go into a lot of detail. Because in an article, for example, where NASA Standard Science publishes a concept, to the undiscerning eye, you would think that, somebody's done their homework, where they say that there are nomad planets out there. In this article, they're talking about 100,000 times more nomad planets than there are regular planets. For example, in our solar system, we have 9 planets. Then, magically, a couple years ago, astronomers decided that Pluto shouldn't be a planet. And the reason they did that is because they found 40 other planets out there that are Pluto-like, the same size, more or less, as Pluto, and are orbiting the sun. And they had two choices. They could either say, well, now we have 40 planets, and the average guy in the street would go, well, huh? 40 planets? I thought there were 9. I learned that all the way through grade school. Now there's 40. And so instead of having that question popping up in the public's mind, and then the public would say, well, if there's 40, why not 400? Because you're just starting to discover these. And if there's some big ones, couldn't some of them come into the solar system, inner solar system, be on orbits that could be damaging to the inner solar system? And Planet X. So they couldn't do that. They couldn't have that. So they had to demote Pluto from being a planet. Now they don't have to talk about all the other planets out there that they have discovered. But now astronomers are saying that there is 100,000 times more planets in the galaxy than planets in solar systems or stellar systems, stellar planetary systems like our own. 100,000 times more. 100,000 times more. Not 100,000 more. 100,000 times more. So if we have 9 planets in our solar system, or let's give the astronomers benefit of the doubt, there's 8 planets, they say, then there would be 800,000 Planet X's out there somewhere whizzing around in outer space, not associated with stars. But how do they determine this? First of all, I think they have a completely bogus, false reading to begin with, although there are items out there. And my galaxy paper that I published many years ago, decades ago, in the standard astrophysics journals explains where these come from. They come from the galactic nucleus region when the galactic arms are formed, but that's not the point. The point is that they are using a technique called gravitational microlensing. How does that work? Okay, let's say you have a gravitational heavy object moving along through space. Then when you're looking at a star, all of a sudden you will see 2 stars, and then it goes back to 1. And so that's what's happening with stars. Astronomers are observing stars, and they go, oh, this one split, and then it's back together. That must be due to gravitational lensing of something flying between it and us. And so this happens so frequently that they go, there's a boatload of planets just flying around out there. Do you want to know how difficult it is for a rogue planet just flying through space to get between a star and us while we're observing it? It's almost impossible. I would say that it is so remotely impossible that it could never happen. Even if there were a lot of these remote planets out there. So at any rate, the concept that microlensing is discovering these planets, remember, they're not observing these planets, they're observing an effect. And if that effect is caused by something else, then their estimate that there's 100,000 planets out there for every few that are in a stellar system like our own, that's a bogus estimate. It's based on misinterpretation of data, nothing more, nothing less. And I would say that's what's going on. But this is standard fairy tale science. So at any rate, that's my estimation of what's going on here. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that there are hundreds of thousands of times more planets floating around out in outer space than are associated with planets. Wouldn't that tell you that probably a lot of the current planets are captured? And if they can be captured, now I want to read this particular line here. It's a caption of the picture, and they draw this kind of fuzzy blue ball to depict one of these rogue nomad planets. They say this is an artistic rendition of a nomad object wandering through interstellar medium. The object is intentionally blurred to represent uncertainty about whether it has an atmosphere. A nomad object may be an icy body akin to an object found in the outer solar system. Okay, I want to stop there. they're saying that this could be a rocky object with ice on it, on the surface. Well, gee, what if one of these things came into the solar system, Mr. Standard Scientist or Mr. NASA Scientist? Wouldn't that become just one of the biggest comets you ever saw? And if it came near a planet like Earth, wouldn't it have all kinds of effects, including gravitational effects? You know, according to their own ridiculous dirty snowball comet model, which says that comets are little, they can't be big, here they're talking about something that's icy, and if there's hundreds of thousands of them out there, it's just a matter of time till one of them's going to come in the solar system and show its ugly head and come raging through the solar system and become a big comet. So this is what I'm talking about. If you know what to look for in these articles, you know to pick up the contradictions. Okay, the next thing I want to examine is how on earth did these objects form? The standard science mechanism for formation of planets, and by the way, they're very emphatic about this, that the planets are formed around a star, that it takes this coagulating effort of the major star. In other words, the star is big, it pulls in dust and gas, it keeps it in a rotating disk, and that's where the planets form. Well, the models, the computer modeling of planet formation don't agree with what we see. If you look from the north side of the solar system, the sun spins in a counterclockwise direction, and all of the planet orbits spin in counterclockwise directions. This is looking from the north side of Earth or the north side of the solar system. Okay, if you had a rotating dust cloud, and it, by the simple gravitational physics, the particles farther from the sun would go around the sun slower. They would be in an orbit, they would take a longer time to go around the sun, and they're moving slower. So if a body coagulated out of this dust, the outside side of the planet would be moving slower than the inside planet, and the planet would start to spin in a clockwise direction. All the planets spin in counterclockwise direction. So you know what they do? They say, well, all of the planets must have been hit by asteroids, and that changed all their directions. More fairy tale science. None of the explanations that they've come up with make any sense. The first person to come up with that idea of the rotating gas cloud was a guy named Laplace, and it's called the Laplacian gravitational theory. Well, it seems to work fine, but of all people, Laplace should have been able to figure out that the planets would all rotate backwards. Since then, astronomers have figured that out because people like me have told them, and then they go, oh, well, it must have been hit by an asteroid. So they can put a Band-Aid on anything, on any of their ridiculous theories, and not really have to account for it. And then secondly, there's no theoretical observation. No one has ever seen a solar system form. They've seen stars with dust clouds around them. They've seen planets in these dust clouds, but nobody has ever literally, really witnessed a planet form around a star, let alone our own. Well, I don't think anybody that I know was around at that time. So the question is, how do these rogue planets form? Because remember, they're out in interplanetary space. And so that's where things are really empty. Just to give you an idea how empty space is, let's talk about the far edge of the universe. Okay, we have our own stellar system here with the sun and the 8 or 9 planets. Okay, so that's a star in our galaxy. Our galaxy is, there are billions of galaxies out there, and so the distance between galaxies is absolutely enormous. Okay, now, look at the amount of matter between us at the surface of the Earth and 60 miles up. In other words, look at the amount of matter in the air, in the atmosphere of Earth. Okay, now let's do this on a really, really clear day. There's no clouds, there's no dust, there's no contamination, there's no pollution, just a perfectly clear day, and you're looking up through 60 miles of gas that surrounds our planet. Remember, no water vapor, no clouds, no dust, no gas, other than our pure atmosphere, no pollution, just pure Earth atmosphere, dry. Okay, so you're looking up through this atmosphere. It goes up to, it thins out to almost nothing at about 60 miles up. Okay, now go from that point, the upper atmosphere, all the way across the other side of the universe. There is more matter, there are more molecules, there's more obstruction in that clean atmosphere with no clouds, no dust, anything, than there is going all the way across the other side of the universe. That's how empty space is out there. And so the point is, now they're asking you to believe that rogue planets, nomad planets, somehow magically formed out there where there's no dust, gas, or anything. It is so empty out there, it's emptier than empty. So at any rate, this is why I'm kind of picking this article apart, that scientists are claiming these nomad planets exist out there. Why am I doing this? Because these are peer-reviewed journals. Somebody's supposed to be reading these. Somebody's supposed to be reading this and allowing this to be printed. And this is supposed to be the respectable journal that contains the epitome of Western knowledge. Absolutely beyond absurd. Fairy tale science. And by the way, they don't ever mention how any of these things could possibly be. They just go, for example, just kind of off the cuff, they say, this new class of celestial object will affect current theories of planet formation and could change our understanding the origin and abundance of life. What a general fairy tale type of statement. How on earth do they expect people, rational people, to accept science? This really, to me, makes science very boring. Let me talk a little bit about what's really going on here. I believe, first of all, that their study is corrupted, that they're seeing another effect. There's another effect that's causing the image of a star to split, and it's really not due to the fact that a planet, a rogue planet, is somehow coming between that star and ourselves in the middle of intergalactic space. I just don't see it as being true. Also, let's look at the concept of gravitational microlensing. What does that involve? Okay, that involves the general theory of relativity, which has never been proven. You can't get stars and galaxies and quasars into your laboratory because they're too big. You can't go out and lasso one and bring it into your laboratory. So all of the proofs for general relativity are mainly theoretical proofs. If such and such is true, then such and such is true. and then from there on, they develop fairly complicated mathematics and develop all of the results of space, time, continuum, etc., of general relativity. Well, Einstein himself criticized general relativity. He said special relativity that talks about the movement of light is very well defined. The experiments, you can do them in the laboratory, and it makes perfect sense. You can prove special relativity in a laboratory, but general relativity, which deals with massive objects in outer space, is not something that you can prove in a laboratory. So all of the proofs, all of the concepts of general relativity are simply unprovable. Einstein In his book, it's called "In Out of My Later Years," I believe is the name of the book. When Einstein was writing his own bibliography, his autobiography, he has a page in there, and I reference this in one of my books. It's a famous quote, and he says that he really doesn't believe general relativity, that there's an equivalence kind of thought experiment, that if you're in an elevator and you're doing experiments and you are in an inertial frame of reference, in other words, not accelerated, then all of your experiments should come out the same as if you were just free-floating in outer space. But if that elevator accelerates up, then light should coming in one wall of the elevator, a hole in one wall of the elevator, should actually hit a little bit lower when it gets across to the other side of the elevator, to the other wall. It should drop down, and you should be able to see that as if it were curving. And so the principle of equivalence says that the inertial frame of reference is going to be equivalent to the same experiment done in the gravitational field of a planet or a star. And Einstein says that assumption is wrong. It's never been proven, and it's just sitting out there. And so what have people done? They've taken and made very complicated theoretical work around general relativity, and it's never been proven. The basic fundamental concept of general relativity has never been proven. So when science talk about microgravitational lensing, they're basing it on a theory, the theory of general relativity, that has never been proven. How can you possibly go on in science with such a major gap, yet everybody refers to this? Then you have these guys coming along, developing the concept that nomad planets are out there, something that really doesn't have a basis. How did these planets form? They just write it off and say, oh, we need a new theory. Well, you need more than a new theory. You need matter to make the planet out of. I don't care what your theory says. If you don't have the matter to make the planet, you can't make the planet. It's as simple as that. So there again, there's so many flaws and holes in this, but then they go on to say that this is where life comes from. They say that bacteria somehow could live on these nomad planets. Well, if it could live there, why can't it live on Jupiter? Why can't it live on Earth? They're around the sun. They have a better probability of growing life and DNA than something sitting there out in the middle of the galaxy all by itself. You see what I mean? None of this makes any sense at all. And then they say that life could be harbored there, and then this nomad planet crashes into something out there in the middle of intergalactic space. They don't say how these collisions could happen, nor do they make any estimate of how frequently these collisions could happen. And then all of these pieces are supposed to end up on a planet like Earth to germinate life. A scenario so improbable if you go step by step by step. Let me talk a little bit about probability and statistics. If you have a statistical process that has one step in it, and say that statistics of that happening, the probability of that happening is 10%, then if you repeat the event over and over again, you'll, out of 10 such events, on average, you'll have one of them succeed. Now let's string a bunch of probabilistic events together. Let's say you have a two-step probabilistic event and 10% chance of the first thing happening. And if the first one happens, you have a 2% chance of the second stage happening. Okay, so 10%, you get 10 out of 100 of the first one. Now you get 2 out of 100 if the first step succeeds. You start seeing the multiplication of probability and statistics to get a result. It's only 0.2% probability that the second stage will terminate in a success. Okay, now start stringing 2, 3, 4, 5 things together, And the probabilities of those things happen, multiplying those probabilities together, little teeny numbers, when you multiply them together, get littler and teenier. Okay? And so what happens is, say you, what's the probability of a nomad planet forming? Well, I'd say it's about zero, is very, very small. And they're claiming that they're more abundant out there than all of the rest of the planets around stars. Yet there's no matter out there to form these planets out of. So what's the probability of them forming? Pretty much zero. Okay, multiply that by then, the probability that bacteria somehow leapfrogs onto these and is cultured there and harbored there. Okay, what's the probability? Where did that bacteria come from? They don't talk about that. That's the big glaring mystery in this whole thing. How did bacteria, where did that come from? Where did it start from? See how they leave that main point completely out of the discussion. It puts it off one point removed, and they don't talk about it. And then this nomad planet has to collide with another nomad planet out there to break into a billion pieces. Now those pieces have to find their way off to an existing planet that's in a stellar system with other planets, and then survive the impact or the passage through the atmosphere of that planet with the bacteria intact to start generating life on that planet. Do you see how remotely improbable this scenario is? Yet it's touted as being one of the main new avenues of research. Now, if you listen, I want you to go back and listen to my last few weeks' shows, because I talk about the Planet X scenarios and how Planet X's are very important in the building of life on the and the steps, evolutionary steps, when these major catastrophes come in from outer space. They have a dramatic effect on the planet. And that causes the steps in life, in the evolution of life, to change radically and quickly. It prevents the monopolization of a specific species. That includes bankers, by the way. Not to bring up a sore point with some of the bankers who I know listen to this show. They're more vulnerable than any of us because their power is at stake. So at any rate, I just wanted to go over this article that came out. Pick it apart so you can see the kind of ridiculous fairy tale science being pawned off on the public, and compare that with the last couple weeks where I'm talking about the damage and the benefits of Planet X type objects. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.